Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to Online with an Architect. My name is Josh Hodges. I'm your host today. I'm very happy to have Anthony McMahon with us. Welcome.
Thank you, Josh, and pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me on.
Fantastic. Well, we've actually never met before. I just see you on CIO chat on Twitter quite a bit, and I thought we should talk about a few things. The thing that inspired me to reach out was you had a tweet, and I'll read it out. It said, discussing over coffee, which I have in my hand as well.
Likewise.
What in the cloud really means. For many orgs, they aren't really in the cloud. They're simply on cloud, a variation of on-prem. And I think that's probably very true. And yeah, just discussing what on-prem means, what on-cloud is, what cloud native is, and what, if any, are the other options. So yeah, keen to jump in. Do you want to do a quick intro yourself before we dive in?
Absolutely, because probably for some of your listeners, they'll pick up that my accent's even further south than your accent. I'm Anthony McMahon, as you said in the intro. I'm a New Zealand-based consulting CIO, CTO. It depends on the need for the clients that I work with as to which one that is, but I've got a background in both enterprise and business architecture. I worked for one of our larger banks, BNZ, for a number of years in the architecture capacity and in the service management capacity as well. So I evolved from service management to enterprise and business architecture. I use those two interchangeably. We weren't big enough to have a broader function of architects. There was a lot of mixing going on in those roles.
Yeah, fantastic. Actually, do you want to, just putting you on the spot, do you want to give us your thoughts on what an enterprise architect is versus, say, a solution architect?
Yeah, I'm just gathering my thoughts on that one because I do have a view. I find that many enterprise architects I run into, through no fault of their own, it's the job title they've landed in, but they are ultimately a senior solution architect, and they're not truly in that enterprise architecture view. For me, an enterprise architect is someone who's there. They understand the broad technology landscape that a business has around it, and they understand how technology will enable business outcomes. That's different to a solution architect and a senior solution architect who's getting more involved in the piecing together of what a solution is actually going to look like. And I guess to compare it to a real world architect as opposed to an IT architect, you have the architect who designs what the building's going to look like. They take the customer requirements and they create a building. And then they hand it off to the engineer who determines, is that building actually going to stand up? And how are they going to pull the concrete? Where are they going to pull the concrete? How far do the foundations need to go? What is the cladding going to be made of? And I see that kind of similarity between an architect and an engineer in the construction world as being the linkage between an enterprise architect who's designing the building and showing how the business outcomes are enabled, and the solution architect who's playing more into that engineering, how deep are the foundations going.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I think the other thing I'd add is those people need to overlap. They need to work together. It's not one and the other. People can do both roles, but you need to overlap. It's not just one guy hands it over the fence and says good luck. That collaboration, I think, is really key for a business to be successful.
100%. Yeah, totally. They can't work in isolation. There is a natural merging of the two. Don't get me wrong, a solutions architect can absolutely become an enterprise architect. But for me, I just feel that too often the solution architect gets called the enterprise architect, but they're still doing solution architecture.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think the name, it takes on a lot of different meanings for different companies. And a lot of the time, yeah, a technical person is promoted up the ranks over the years to an enterprise architect, when really what they're saying is that they're a very good solution architect. I think the word enterprise in that context is very good as opposed to business minded. And I think we need to make sure that any solution has a business angle and a technical angle, hence enterprise and solution architecture are different roles, which can be performed by one person potentially, but often it's better to have multiple specialists.
100%. And much the same way that across construction, if we use that analogy again, construction, the engineer and the architect need to work closely together. But an engineer who's building on reclaimed land is going to have a different speciality to an engineer who's building on bedrock. And you can't just bring... There's a team of people around there that needs to work in it. Same as technology. There's a team of people that need to work, whether it's an online or an offline world, understanding what things are going to be are going to be looking like.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. So I think that probably gets us into our first point of the day, which is what does on-prem mean, or on-premises? You hear it all the time. So what are your thoughts? What's the definition of this in your mind?
So to me, on-prem is just anything that's literally physically hosted where you are, or close to where you are, is I guess the differentiator there. You know, you as an organization are responsible for the feeding and watering of the machine, the hardware, the equipment, and everything that goes into it. So that's the power, the maintenance, the service. It may be in your own premise. It may be in the broom cupboard at the back of the office, or it might be in a data center somewhere else where it's hosted, but you're still maintaining and feeding it. To me, that's on-prem. If you're responsible for the end-to-end commissioning through to decommissioning of the service and everything in between, you're on-prem.
Yeah, it's basically your stuff. Is long and the short of it. You own it, you're responsible, and that's it.
Correct. And
then we move into, what is a private cloud? What are your thoughts on this? Because I feel like we're going to have a lot of overlap in this conversation, and hopefully that clarifies it for everyone.
Yes. Yeah. Look, private cloud's always the one that gets me a bit, because ultimately the managed service, or the managed hosting service that we saw companies move to over the last 30 years, where they outsourced the management of the server, maybe didn't own the server, but they still ran their applications on it. To me, that was a little bit of private cloud. It was still a physical hosting, but what changed with that versus private cloud is private cloud probably just brought a lot more virtualization into it. But for me, private cloud is literally, it's your environment. You're not sharing it with anyone else, but someone else is managing it for you.
Mm. Yeah, so very similar to on-premises. It's just really how it's managed. So
correct.
We're not really talking about much differentiation at the hardware layer. We're really talking about operationally how it's looked after.
Yeah.
So MSPs and so forth. Absolutely. So in our list, I actually didn't write public cloud, which is quite hilarious. So let's talk now. What's public cloud? What does this mean?
So, I mean, that's just that evolution of you've taken from on-prem to more of an infrastructure as a service model, but you're sharing it with a range of other people. So you're operating in the same playground, for want of a better word. And while everyone is operating in their own little fenced area of that playground, they're still in the same playground. They're sharing resources. They're sharing load rather than one single server being responsible for them. To me, that's public cloud. Very simplified view, I know, and people will take a more technical view on it, but to me, it's just as simple as that.
Yeah, absolutely. So then we've got things like cloud native, which to a lot of people, they think, well, public cloud, cloud native, is this the same thing? What are your thoughts?
No, I don't think they're the same thing. For me, the cloud native is probably, and that's where the on-prem versus on-cloud conversation that I mentioned in that tweet you referred to came from. Cloud native is really, it's being built from the cloud, or from a cloud first perspective. Take AWS as an example. You've got a suite of services that run within AWS, all the Lambda functions, the S3 buckets, everything that's in there. You start to piece them together as an architecture, and that's cloud native. You know, it's going to run in the cloud. The difference to me with that versus what I called on cloud is where you had some physical file servers and maybe they were linked and running an application across them. Maybe they were an application server and you've taken them and you've virtualized them and you've moved them up to AWS and you're hosting them in AWS. That for me is the difference between a cloud native versus on cloud.
Yeah, interesting. So you're differentiating based on whether the provider has offered the service or whether you've just moved something into the service.
Correct. Correct. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think if you've got a cloud provider that's offering a service and you're moving a legacy thing into it, then you should probably try and utilize the native service. It's probably optimal. It's probably more cost effective potentially and more suitable to the service. So I think that's probably a journey customers are going to go on. They're going to probably migrate some stuff as is and then potentially try and, you know, make it utilize those native features.
Correct. Yeah. It's if you took an app that was built maybe 10, 15 years ago and moved it onto cloud to get to that cloud native point, I'd see a huge degree of re-architecting and re-engineering. Say huge, that's hyperbole. Depends on how big the app is really. But there would be a degree of re-engineering and re-architecting to get it to cloud native versus if you just lifted and shifted it to remove the burden of managing your own tin, then that's where you're going to get to that on-cloud model.
Yeah, absolutely. So then customers have chosen whichever one of these models. They've either they're on premises, they've got a private cloud, an MSP, they're cloud native, or they've got some other solution. Do you see customers getting stuck somewhere? Is there a lock-in aspect that we need to consider, or is this just marketing speak for competitive companies?
Yes and no. Cloud native obviously is going to bring a bit of lock-in with it. If you're building with AWS services specifically, or if you're using some of the native Azure services, then you're going to get locked in by the nature of your architecture, and it's harder to move away. But that's a conscious decision that an organization should make. And it's no different to what we did see 20 or 30 years ago when we were building monoliths, where we would lock ourselves into a development pathway because of the tech structure that was chosen. So yes, it's there. Is it a bad thing? I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, as long as you know how to manage that service correctly and keep costs at a level that are sustainable. If there's a fairly good train of thought out there that anyone who tries to move to the cloud to save costs won't. As long as you're actually managing and maintaining what you're running, it shouldn't matter that you're locked into AWS for the next 20 years. The risk you carry, of course, is that they do what Google does so well, and they start switching services off and removing them from the stack that you offer. But that's, again, where that solutions architect becomes very, very valuable to an organization, because they have a deep understanding of how the application's running, and they have a deep understanding of what the impacts are if certain components are removed or taken out of the stack. So they can start to build and say, look, that's fine. Amazon or AWS are not offering these five functions anymore that were pretty integral to our solution. We're going to roll it back, and we're going to do it this way. So it becomes about disposable architecture more than just locking yourself in a vendor in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other thing that I remember hearing lock-in years ago when I worked at IBM, it seemed to kick off about, I don't know, 12, 15 years ago or something, is when I first sort of heard that term. And it was actually a colleague of mine at the time, and we were designing a VMware solution based on NetApp storage, and we were using the Snap Manager suite for the backups, so and the replication and whatever. And he goes, well, what if we have to change NetApp? We're too locked in. We can't use all these features, otherwise we're trapped, you know? And I was like, well, sure, yeah, we're going to use these features, but what's the alternative? If we don't use these features, then we're going to have a really inefficient, you know, outdated, you know, high overhead backup and recovery system, which is going to mean we're going to have to design the solution to be more performant and larger and all this kind of stuff. So to me, it was a trade-off between getting value out of a solution, whether it be AWS, whether it be an on-premises solution or whatever it is, versus having the ability to move at any time, but having a pretty basic low-value offering. So I think I'm sort of the opinion that let's use functionality. Let's get the most value out of a product or a solution. But as you say, at the back end, what is our mitigation? You know, if the service is deprecated, how do we move? How long is that going to take? What's the process, and what's the impact short, medium, and long term? So I think you hit the nail on the head there that lock-in is sort of inevitable, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. If you were to architect to such a point where it was virtually impossible to move off a service, or if something became deprecated that you were offline, you've gone too far. Your solution architecture has probably failed you at that point, and your enterprise architect has probably not set out the requirements sufficiently to ensure that didn't happen as well. So there's probably failures at multiple layers if companies got to that point.
Yeah, I would agree. If it ultimately is what you've just described as a cloud monolith, and that's what you want to avoid. But just like over the last decade, we've wanted to avoid monoliths in general. Same thing goes with the cloud. If you've completely architected it so that you cannot break it apart, and have a disposable mindset around some of that tech, then that's where you've failed. But if you've locked yourself in where you're saying, look, as long as AWS keeps offering these services, or as long as these services are offered through some platform, we're going to use them, that's fine. But as you say, it's the trade-offs, and then it's also understanding what the alternatives are as well. You know, maybe we chose this function over function A over function B because it's cheaper, it's faster, it's more reliable. However, if they switch off function A, we know that we can fall back to function B. And there's going to be a cost trade-off, but we've at least got a a fallback plan, or even call it a business continuity plan.
Yeah, absolutely. I think business continuity is a term that everyone links to just disaster recovery, but that's only one piece of business continuity. It's making sure that we can continue doing business, right, regardless of the scenario. So it might even be something simple as the performance of a service has degraded, you know, due to a managed service provider or a cloud provider. The service is now oversubscribed to such a point that you're feeling an impact, and that's impacting your ability to transact. You know, that's impacting business continuity. It's a SLA breach potentially, and people don't usually factor that in. They assume that the cloud provider or an MSP is just going to have unlimited resources and never have performance issues or outages, which obviously is not the case. So
no, it's definitely not. I don't remember having this conversation with a senior business stakeholder going back a few years now. This was when I was at the bank, and our website had some stability issues over a sustained period. And I raised the question and said, look, why don't we have a dashboard up that just shows what's going on to our customers, what's up and what's down and why not? And I got the pushback of, oh, why would we do that? No one puts a dashboard up. Not even Google would put a dashboard up to show where they're at. And so I showed them the link of the Google RAG view that showed how their services were performing globally at any one time. So it's that monitoring and maintenance that becomes valuable as you start to decompose that architecture a little bit as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, as you say, it's important to understand what the provider can do and what it can't do, and then monitor it. So if you are hitting areas where you're starting to see degradation, or potentially you're getting to those thresholds, you need to know where to pivot. And I think that's another gap, is people assume that the service stays where it is and, you know, AWS will fix it if there's a problem. Well, they may well do that, but it may take 8 hours, whereas you might have a business impact for 8 hours and you need to have continuity. So what do you do in that scenario? So I think that's a very interesting piece. And from a budgetary perspective, actually, at that enterprise layer, factor that in, that you've got to make a quick shift from one platform to another, and what that might look like as sort of insurance policy.
Definitely, definitely. And look, coming into that outage piece, as we say, anything can happen. I was once part of a conversation where we were asked how much it would cost to get to, it was basically asking zero RPO. But what the implied question was actually, what's it going to cost for us to never have a failure? And this was in an org that was running a lot of on-prem, because they had a lot of legacy stack that they hadn't migrated and invested away, but everything was on-prem. And they were running there was a primary data center, and then there was what was considered the DR, and it wasn't a hot site, that DR site. And my response, there's a few responses, and people were talking about architecting the cost out. I said, no, ultimately to get to a zero RPO, or to get to 100% uptime, what you're talking about is the cost of minimum of 3 data centers that are mirrored in real time and are all active 24/7. Because once you've got that, and that's the same in cloud as well, if you want to guarantee 100% uptime, you've got to start looking at multi-region or multi-zonal architecture, so that you can start to fail over as something happens in the Sydney region, or once it comes online just down the road, the New Zealand region as well.
Yeah, and I think the other thing to combine there is, it's not just infrastructure being online, the application has to be online. So you've got to have resiliency at multiple layers of any solution to achieve anywhere near that sort of level.
Correct.
I think the idea of, say, active data centers, which I've heard a lot over the last sort of 10 years, especially with virtualization, we've got active data centers, so, you know, we're all good. We can vMotion between them, or we can do whatever between them. Yeah, that's not really 100% uptime. That's, you know, potentially going to save you in a couple of scenarios. If you go through each of the different failure scenarios, it very quickly becomes apparent that active introduces new risks as well. So it introduces, say, performance overheads, and there's various other issues. So having a very comprehensive architecture is critical to understanding how the solutions work, how they fail, what's the impact of failure, what risks are we mitigating, and under what scenarios, what is the impact, how likely are the impacts, you know, things like that. So I love going through with customers, putting through a table showing them the likelihood and the impact of risks, and then talking about all the various mitigations and the pros and the cons. And people's eyes sort of open up and they sit back in their chair and they go, wow, we had no idea that, you know, achieving a high level of uptime was you know, this much consideration. And of course, cost.
And it's a good point. And again, it's trade-offs and balances in that conversation. I'm completely with you with impact likelihood scenario modeling being key. You know, you can sit down with the what's the impact of if this piece of technology is unavailable, whether it be at an application layer or further down the stack. That could be critical on the business, but the likelihood could be incredibly low. And then you start to measure it up and go, cool, so the likelihood is low, the impact is critical, you're offline. What's the worst case scenario and how much is that worth to your business? And then how much are you, how much is it going to cost you to close that gap between the impact and the likelihood? So it might cost you $1 billion to completely mitigate that risk. You're never going to manage it. You're never going to eliminate it. You're only going to mitigate it. But if the worst case scenario of that $1 billion spend, if you don't do it, if the worst case scenario is you'll lose $10 million, well, are you better to save the $990 million? And just run the risk that you might lose 10 million one day. And if you are, great, but document it so that it's clear that we made this decision and we understand why we've done this. And then that ties back into our architecture as well, so that when someone comes in and says, what about that? We can turn around and go, yep, we've used risk modeling. We understand it, and it forms part of our critical architecture approach as well.
Yeah, and you touched on a point that I love as well is actually documenting architectural decisions. It's a little pet hobby of mine. I love doing it because once you write something down, first of all, someone else can understand it. Now, let's say you document something to a very poor standard. Someone reads it and goes, "What does this mean, Josh?" Oh, sorry, yeah, I should really complete that correctly. So I think documenting it simply makes sure that it's clear. I like to go to a lot of detail on these decisions because I find that's my way of checking my own work. And then when I hand it off to someone like yourself, you're going to go, cool, yeah, this makes sense. You've got a problem statement, you've got your requirements, you've got all your risks, your justifications, your alternatives, you've considered everything. And then you might go, cool, this makes perfect sense to me. Or you might say, Josh, that assumption there, not true. And then I go, oh, wow, I've got to completely change this decision. So I think those are really critical. And especially most people won't read a design document, whether it's a solution or an enterprise document, most people won't read it. But what I have found is I can give people a list of architectural decisions that are formatted in a table that are pretty easy to read. And a lot of the time I'll get feedback on them. And I'm like, wow, okay, cool, this is good. So I've got all my document sets over here, but the subset that I'm going to share, which I usually do quite early on in the design process, I try and draft out a lot of decisions. I seem to get a lot more feedback on those than I do if I just give documents. So I think that's a strategy that has been successful for me, at least. Have you done similar things?
Yeah, I've definitely followed through with the documentation side. And before I jump into the approach that I take, I'll actually talk about some of the examples I've seen, even recently, where the architecture decisions aren't documented. Mm-hmm. And as an application has evolved through its development process, the architect actually has become a critical point of failure or a single point of failure because everything that has been done is sitting in their head. So documentation de-risks the business overall as well. If you can articulate that in 2018, we made these decisions at that time, and then we're now in 2023 and we're sitting down to do an architecture review, even if the original solution architect who made those decisions and the original architecture team who made those decisions have moved on, the decisions that the document last is an enduring point where we can sit there and go, cool, I understand that. That was made at that point in time because of A, B, and C assumptions. However, the world's changed and now we can rewrite the decision, but we know at least why it was done that way instead of just pulling out a code base or an architecture diagram and going, why did they do that? Why did they go down that path?
People made a decision can be very difficult because there are real genuine reasons where I've looked at a decision someone's made and gone, that makes no sense. This is ridiculous. But then you speak to them and they go, oh, but there was this little caveat that I just had no choice or a constraint. And you go, oh, okay, well, maybe that made sense then, but that's not the case. So to your point, as things evolve, an architectural decision should be a living document. And it should evolve over time, and hopefully the organization's got the flexibility to evolve with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, with my documentation approach, one of the first things I'll do, and this is where that business architect element comes in and where I'll put that hat on, is I'll start to build out the vision for what the business is trying to achieve. And for those familiar with TOGAF and the TOGAF architecture development model, delivery model, the ADM, that business vision is an early phase. I can't remember if it's the first or the second phase, but it's articulating what problems they're trying to solve, and then articulating how the architecture will solve that and also what it won't solve. Because if what the business is trying to achieve is a degree of efficiency and effectiveness in the way they deal with their customers or the way they process transactional information, technology and therefore the underpinning architecture might only ever solve 60% of that. The other 40% might come from process improvement and people improvement. And I was writing one this week actually for a client who they need a CRM, and we'll go off the shelf. We have choices to which CRM it is, but one of the things we've articulated in there is that the CRM is not a replacement for human knowledge, human IP that exists within the business, because the business makes a lot of decisions. They're an insurance underwriter. They make a lot of decisions around client policies and client risk. A CRM is not going to take that away. All it's going to do is optimize workflow from start to finish. So that's part of also for me, the documentation of what the architecture is not becomes just as important as to what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And it sets the expectation as well. If you go, okay, here's what we're trying to achieve, here's what we can do, then highlighting what you are not doing or is required or is a dependency of the organization is key as well. So yeah, I'm a big fan of documentation. I think it's one of those things people don't like to pay for, but it's one of those things that, you know, I'm just not willing to do a project. If a customer is not willing to pay for a reasonable level of documentation, I just don't see that that's a good project for me to be engaged in, because I'm not going to deliver the outcome that I'm committed to delivering if my hands are tied and, you know, I can't do my job. So yeah, that documentation is critical.
And that's full stack documentation as well. It's just as critical for the developers to be documenting what they're doing and the logic behind their code, so that again, as you come to review decisions in a few years' time, you've got that traceability top to bottom. The decisions at the top made by the enterprise architect, the decisions made by the solution architect, and the decisions made by the developer are all tied into each other. They can't operate on their own.
Yeah, traceability is key. So in that table I was referring to earlier, I've got that traceability related decisions and all of them are mapped together. And I think that's the job of the architecture team, is to make sure that the CIO understands how the technical layer is delivering that outcome and it's very traceable. So if you've implemented a product or a solution or some kind of architecture and you can't explain why and how it's meeting this business level requirement, then you know, guys like us haven't done our job. So it's critically important to, you know, understand how the problem's being solved and why. And also, like you say, what the gap is and where the organization has to change, because, you know, tech can only go so far. If someone's got this archaic old policy that someone wrote 50 years ago, oh, we must do this and we must do that, and all that is, a lot of people just say, oh, that's the policy, I'll never change it. Whereas I like to challenge it, is that policy still relevant today? And in my mind, like I always say, I still get letters from my bank in the mail, and I check my mailbox about once a month. So if you want to get information to me in a timely manner, snail mail, as it's called, I guess, affectionately, is not the way to go. But banks, some of them still have, you know, you have to send you a statement once a year or something in the mail. And, you know, half of us probably never read them. We just throw them straight in the recycle. And that's an example of an organizational policy that is affecting IT solutions. You know, there's a system somewhere that's printing out all those letters. Why? Yeah, for what value?
I completely agree. And I saw one the other day, which we're challenging with the client as well. One of the clients I work with is getting cybersecurity insurance. The policy documents that came through, the hoops they have to jump through to be eligible for an insurance claim if it ever comes to it, included all of their passwords must change every 45 days.
Mm.
And I just took a look at that and went, well, that's well outside of industry standards now. And was talking with an associate of mine, and we laughed about the point that the 45-day password policy was a Windows NT 4 policy.
Mm.
We've evolved in 25 years. Clearly, that insurance company hasn't. It's not the same insurance company I mentioned before, different one. just making sure that those ones don't cross. clearly, they haven't updated their policy, so they've latched onto something from two. Gosh, what was NT4? That was about 98, wasn't it, that it came out?
Yeah,
so they've latched onto that, and they haven't updated. But Windows have even got to the point now where if you get right into the back of 365 and look at the secure score, Windows actually, or Microsoft, encourages you not to expire your passwords and to have solid MFA and good password rules in place. So suddenly we've got a very big disconnect between an industry leader and let's call them an industry laggard and that insurer of what that client should be doing. And if the client wasn't in a position to challenge and push back, it could have cost them a lot more to try and meet that policy than it was actually worth.
Yeah, so I think anytime a customer gets a requirement, I used to love it. Yeah, I used to work at Nutanix, so we were a little startup. And, you know, vendors would say, or software vendors or application vendors would say, oh, we're only supported in this configuration, and it would align to something that was VMware. And obviously there wasn't any standards for hyperconverged infrastructure. So they're like, oh, your SAN must have this and your host must do this. And there's very specific technical requirements. Mm-hmm. But they didn't map back to an outcome. So I would always challenge these providers, say, hey, look, customers bought this. They're running VMware on this new thing called Nutanix. It's hyperconverged. It works kind of like this. Delivers the same sort of outcome, but in a different way.
Mm.
So what are you trying to ensure your customers are achieving with the infrastructure? Because I can tell you how we map back to that, but we don't have a dual controller SAN. So straight away, we're failing your requirements, and your support team are pushing back saying we don't have a dual controller SAN, or we're not running on iSCSI, or we're not running on Fibre Channel, or one of these very technical points when it was a highly resilient, scalable, performant shared storage platform, which is really what they're asking for. But yep. Their support policy was so archaic that they got pushback. So I'm one of those people who likes to challenge it. Sounds like you're very similar.
Yep.
But maybe that's from where we are in the world. Kiwis and Australians are a bit like that.
Pushback.
Yeah.
Why are you doing that?
So I always ask that question, and sometimes people say, oh, Josh, it's just how we do it. Just, you know, you got to leave some things alone. And I'm like, I don't think I do. I would like to ask that question, because if there's no good reason that we're constrained by this, I would like to investigate what we can do differently, because the flow-on effects of some of these old policies can be enormous and very costly for architecture. So, I always try to challenge those things. And what I find is the projects I run, the first stage will take longer than the average consulting company. The average consulting company will accept a lot of things and, that's fine, whatever, we'll just go with the flow. So my engagements will take slightly longer at the start, but the outcome will be either quicker or of a higher standard. So I think that planning phase at the start is so important. Otherwise you get this modern solution. You know, you might be going to a public cloud or something, but it's hamstrung by some old policy or an old way of doing things, which makes it either more costly or complicated and risky and things like that. So, it's a little rant from me anyway.
Definitely. And just on that theme as well, it's where I find experimentation and particularly proof of concepts very valuable. And even as an architect, it should be something that sits in a tool bag. Even there might be a cost to run an experiment, but it at least allows you to chase down a hypothesis. And I'll use the example I had this morning, actually. One of the clients that I am working with in a VCTO role, and it's playing more of an architecture role, they have developed over a number of years their own in-house application.
Mm-hmm.
They've developed it at pace, and they've had a very small development team, and they haven't documented it as they've gone. So there's a big risk in there that we just don't understand that logic. And if anything was to evolve for that business, if the developers move on, we lose all that IP and how do we get it back? And with the emergence of large language models coming through, I was sitting with the leadership team recently and said, look, why don't what we're talking about now is the risk of no documentation and the cost to have one of your developers out of their job documenting for the next 6 months, based on how much code is there.
Mm.
Why don't we run an experiment and see if one of the large language models can help us build that documentation? Even if it gets to 80%, it's going to be better than where we are today. And that might mean at 80%, one of those developers is sitting down for 2 weeks, just refining the documentation and getting it to good enough. And we looked and went, yep, that sounds great. So we kicked off the process and we've ended up bringing in a third party who has skills and working with the LLMs to help us because we don't have that skills internally. And they've come back and they've put a dollar figure on the experiment, $5,000 Kiwi.
Mm.
So what's the exchange rate? About $3,000 US, roughly. So they've put that dollar value on it. And one of the business leads said, oh, it's a lot of money to spend. And what if it's not successful? And I said, there's no way this experiment can't succeed because our hypothesis is, or our problem is that manual documentation costs too much time and money to get done. And our hypothesis is that a large language model could do it faster.
Mm.
So if we spend the $5,000 and we prove the hypothesis right, we haven't lost. If we spend the $5,000 and we find that actually the large language model doesn't do it, what we've proven is the hypothesis is wrong. And we just stop sitting there going, what if, what if, what if, and kicking the can down the road. What we now know is that we actually have to sacrifice that developer. So the hypothesis is proven one way or the other, and we win. It's $5,000 well spent. I said, look, if you add another zero on the back of that and that experiment was going to cost us $50,000, I'd start to ask a lot more questions. But for a very low effort approach where we're paying time and materials, I think it was about 2 days work to stand it all up and get it all running. That's what it all boiled down to.
Mm.
It's worth the spend.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, $5,000 in the grand scheme of things, or $3,000 US, is very small for most companies. And if you can, for every decision you made, if it only cost you $5,000 to validate whether it was a good or a bad decision, I think we'd have really good outcomes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I couldn't agree more. Having a developer, sitting there doing documentation, or an architect or engineer or whoever it is, that's a cost, right? It's a cost of obviously that employee, but it's the lack of productivity that's the true cost, because obviously we hire someone because they add a lot of value and their value might be worth millions a year to an organization. So if they're out for 6 months documenting, it's the loss of the value and the cost of that employee. So this number becomes very large.
Correct.
If you've got a valuable employee, which obviously if they're not valuable, you shouldn't have them, but that's what I don't think people put two and two together on the value of an employee. So an experiment like that at that cost, I would think, is very valuable and attractive to most companies.
Mm. And even the outcome of that becomes valuable to become a case study as well, not just for the effort saved or the at least the peace of mind, sleeping better at night. Hey, we did look at that and it's not going to work, so we've got to put a developer on it. The case study that goes to the market that says, hey, we spent a bit of money to try and prove this and we found that it doesn't work, then we can at least put it out to the market and say, save yourself some time and money.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think this brings up a really good point. So one of the things I like to talk about coming from a VMware background is talking about the hyperscaler and hypervisor model, where we're putting a hypervisor on top of a hyperscaler and running virtual machines sort of like we do on-prem but in the hyperscalers. And one of the values I see with that solution is that you've got a very standard platform. It's well documented. It's well understood. And there's skill set out there who have those skills because it's a standard platform. People can go and literally do an AWS or a VMware or a Azure course and understand that solution. So 80% of your documentation and 80% of that layer, which is usually very poorly done on-prem, is done for you. So I feel like that's a huge value of some of these offerings, is it's a well-understood, well-documented architecture. There's enablement there. You don't have to do anything custom. And then it's the 20% on top where people like you and I get involved to make sure people can transition and use that service and, that it delivers all the business and technical requirements. But that to me is an enormous value. Even if the rest of the offering wasn't valuable, just the standardization and having your documentation largely prepared for you is a huge win, I think, for most companies who don't have documentation to a very good standard at all, if any.
Correct. And I'd say that it's probably more common that companies don't have their documentation done right than not.
Mm, absolutely. And that it's outdated. I mean, I've done work for people before, and I'm like, wow, okay, you've got all your documentation. If you change a decision, here's the table, write what it was, make version 1.1, you know, make an alternative and change the decision. And then you come back 2 years later, you know, great people, and some of my customers listening probably laughing, but, you know, they very rarely keep it up to date. And I think, you know, that's critical as part of change management. You know, we have these change approval processes at companies which delay change and, you know, delay projects and things like this for good reason. But a lot of the time they're not adding the full extent to their value because they don't require a reasonable level of documentation. It's more, oh, I'm going to do this change because X. And they go, oh, yeah, that sounds good, and approve. Whereas it should be a properly documented why we're doing it, what's the outcome, what's the risk mitigation, how do we roll back? And rollback strategies are not always easy to write and come up with. But when I see some of these changes, I go, yeah, that's not a rollback strategy, right? Saying, oh, you'll reinstall the previous version. Yeah, there's a few more steps involved in pretty much every tech than just doing that. So, and a lot of technology these days, it's roll forward. Mm. You make a change or an upgrade, you can't go back. Mm. So you actually have to wait for a patch or a fix or a vendor to solve it for you. So, yeah.
And there's even a case study in motion of the impact of change of what, even to a casual observer, hey, that sounds like it should be pretty easy to do, but it's the rebrand of Twitter to X. At a lay perspective, that feels like that's a pretty easy approach technically to do, right? But as we've seen, it happened in stages. The main logo got changed on the site, but there were still references to Twitter and there's still references to tweets. The app was still showing as the old logo, still had the old name. Eventually, and I was just noticing this in almost real time. I wasn't sitting there watching the app as it was happening, but, you know, just observing it. So the website got updated, but on my phone, it took probably another week for the logo of the app to get updated, but it was still the old name. So it was still Twitter underneath it. And it just kept on rolling forward. And obviously that was a change done, we'll say on a whim, because there wasn't a lot of signaling that it was going to happen. It was just on Monday, this is what's happening. To roll that back is going to be very complex. It's not just going to be as simple as update the logo in this database and change the name over here. It's clearly going to be done across multiple different endpoints. And that's the same for any architecture as well, is that rollback, as you say, is never as easy as, oh, we'll just install the last code.
100%. So let's circle back a bit to on-prem and private cloud and public cloud and talk about some pros and cons. So customer's got an on-prem environment, it's up for refresh. What's the pros and cons of staying on-prem?
Going to go down the pro list, obviously, is they have control of everything if they want to. There's an element there that it's going to be more secure, although it will only be as secure as the building that it's housed in. So if it's in the broom cupboard at the back of the office and you've got no alarm and the back door lock's a bit janky, then it's not secure at all. Even less secure if you're running your office environment. If you're a small business and you're running your office environment off a proprietary router that's provided by the ISP, that's just one of the cheap knockoffs out of China. But if that's what you're prepared to trade off, if it's literally just your file server and you're not looking to migrate that anywhere, that may be fine for you. As you scale up to a larger organization, I'm talking very small ones in that example, but as you scale to a larger organization that's running cloud-connected applications hosted on that infrastructure, the pros are still, you've got a lot more control. Mm. And I've seen some blogs recently, and I can't remember which one it was, but it was a fairly well-known SaaS company in the US has migrated back from the cloud. They've publicly stated they're leaving the cloud and they're going back to managing their own environment because absolutely they have more control of the infrastructure pipeline. They have more control of the roadmap that's going on around everything as well. And they've got more control of the cost modeling as well. They were at a bit of a whim on the cost model of that provider. So that, those are the pros. You know, it's more, it can be more secure, it can be more cost effective, and you can have more control of what you're doing. I guess the cons within there are it will cost a lot more. Security comes at a cost. You're responsible for everything and all the risk that goes with that. And you're still dependent on a lot of ifs, buts, and maybes when it comes to the pipeline of a developer. You're still dependent on the infrastructure provider's pipeline as it comes down through to you. So all of that's happening in there. The amount, and I can't speak globally for this, but the amount of New Zealand companies that are still running at least one, if not more, Server 2012 boxes, they just haven't moved off. Whereas if they were in an evergreen environment, that wouldn't be a problem for them. So the cons are in there are just maintainability and cost that comes with it as well.
Yeah, so basically flexibility, great. You've got control, great, but the associated cost is probably the con.
Correct.
You've got all the control, but you've also got all the responsibility and all the cost. Also, you have to have really good, just pitching what we do for a living, you've got to have really good architects. Because if you're managing something yourself and you don't have good architects, whether they're internally or a partner, you're gonna struggle. You're probably going to do some things right out of a bit of luck. You're probably going to do some things right of just general knowledge, but you may get yourself into a position where you're very, very stuck and it may be a huge and complex and costly project to get you out of that bucket. So on-prem can be done very well. You know, if someone says to me, Josh, can your team design us an amazing, you know, on-prem environment that scales like AVS and, you know, has all the cloud native features? Yeah, my answer would be yes, we can. But I'm not sure that you want to pay us the 200 man years it will take us to design that end to end. So that's also the value of having a huge provider that's done a lot of that for you. So I guess that tails us into the next conversation. So a public cloud, what's the pros and cons in your opinion here?
Yeah, so the got to start with the cons there, because cons, it comes into it again, it's security and potentially cost. If you're not managing your costs appropriately, if you don't have a handle on what your spend is in the cloud and you just continue to add more and more into there, that can grow exponentially as well. And security they're pretty robust. The security models that they put in place around the cloud providers, there's still human elements that make them fallible. So those are two of the main issues. But again, and it comes back to the reverse of the on-prem. Big con is you're not in control of the roadmap. You may be able to inform the roadmap and the things that need to happen. And certainly some cloud providers have good forums where they garner that feedback in and they have working groups and user groups and everything else. But you're still not in charge of that roadmap. You're dependent on what they're wanting to do. And location is also a big one. If we look at the hosting model, the local hosting partners that exist out there, and in New Zealand, I'm talking of companies like Datacom and Spark who have local data centers and they host, basically offering infrastructure as a service. You at least know where that is, but with the big three, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft. Microsoft and Amazon are bringing on zones in New Zealand, but right now the only environments that are available to us are over in Australia, or in your way. And
I'll look after you, don't worry. Australians have got New Zealand's back, as we are.
And which is great to know. And look, there's no issue with any of that, but there still brings in different risks. We've got the connectivity risks. We've got just the fact that everything's dependent on a communications channel between your site, the internet, and that zone where the public cloud is as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, if your workloads are online in a public cloud but you can't access them, that's effectively downtime. So that's a risk of having anything that's not close to your users. But at the same time, obviously, if you have a natural disaster or an impact, you know, on-prem, you know, you might have an issue there as well. It doesn't matter if everything's in one spot. If people can't be there, then you've got the same issue, I guess. And with work from home as well, I think a lot of us are now, or probably half the world, still working from home, which I think is a huge value, just putting that out there. You know, a lot of people say, no, we should be in the office and we should be in one spot and this kind of stuff as well. And obviously there's pros and cons there. But yeah, definitely connectivity is critical regardless. Because obviously, like you said about the little router from your ISP, that if someone provides you a piece of equipment, you have no idea what it is or its reliability or its security and you don't have control of it, then that's a pretty big risk. So yeah, just having a random ISP router, probably not a good look.
No, particularly when, you know, governments, our government, your government, and broader had concerns with Huawei a few years ago. And I know one of the ISPs here was just dishing out Huawei devices. So it's that cost trade-off of where are you prepared to put that risk in. And same with even in your data center, if you've got if you don't have any failover for a comms link and comms goes down, you're dead. You're unavailable until that single comms thing comes back up. So it's about having points of failure in there and making sure you've got some redundancy and resilience as well.
Yeah, resilience is like my favorite topic in IT. And you talked about like insurance policies earlier, quite literally for like ransomware and things like this. But to me, what we do as architects is it's an insurance policy for a customer. It's we've got resilient systems. It might be the infrastructure, it might be the application, it might be the connectivity, but we're always putting in these levels of resiliency, which can be thought of as insurance. You know, if someone runs into my car, I don't want to be chasing up repairs and stuff. Oh, that's another story I should rant about. My insurer's hopeless, but I don't want to be chasing this stuff up. I want to drop my car off somewhere and have it sorted out, and have another car. So I'm back on the road and I can get where I need to be. And that's what we do as architects. We're trying to make sure that the business continues on for a reasonably small premium. And I think things like N+1, I did an earlier episode with one of my team, James Worth, and we were just talking about the value of having N+1, whether it be, you know, infrastructure or networking or whatever. You know, the cost of N+1 is usually not that great, but the value it provides is enormous. And the ability to tolerate failures and remain online and get back to a self-healed state, to me, is enormous value. Because I remember back in the day, a customer would have a failure. I'd be at the data center at 3 a.m. replacing hardware just to get them back to a functional state. Whereas technology these days, if you design it correctly with resiliency, who cares about a failure? You could have 3-4 failures. It doesn't even matter. The environment's self-healing, it's providing resiliency, you know, the users are minimally affected, probably just slightly lower performance, but overall there's minimal or no impact. Why wouldn't customers do this? And more importantly, you know, vendors, please make sure by default you're protecting customers. You're not giving them the option of resiliency. It should be by default, is one of my little pet peeves, is when you have little settings that you can, they're either turned off by default, or that they're not well known and well educated, that if you don't turn this on, you realize you can't tolerate a failure or you can't recover from a failure. So, you know, that's something that's a little pet hate of mine.
It's kind of the old story, the CEO and the CFO, you know, talking about training and development, and the CFO saying to the CEO, what happens if we invest in these people and they leave? And the CEO saying, well, what happens if we don't and they stay?
I love this one. The moment you started saying it, I was like, this is a great quote. We'll definitely make a clip out of that one.
It's so perfect. And it's because it's relevant to tech as well. You know, of this, the CTO or the CIO should be saying, having that same conversation with the CFO, where the CFO says, oh, that's resilience. That's going to come at a cost. What happens if we don't invest in it? What's can we really justify investing in it? And the CIO should be sitting there with the stance saying, well, this is what it's going to cost us if we don't. And again, that then actually becomes a decision that's made. If the CIO loses that argument to the CFO and it's decided that, no, we're not going to spend on resiliency, document the decision, write it down, make sure it's noted, move on, because it's an architecture decision. when I say move on, obviously you can keep coming back to it, highlighting the risk that's there, just in case that financial position changes. But if the worst ever happens and the outage ever goes in there, it just becomes a very clear point of technology saying back to the organization, we wanted to be resilient by default, to your point. There was a decision made not to go down that path. We will recover as fast as we can, but let's not blame the technology for what's happened here.
Yeah, I think it's also important, whether we agree or disagree with the decision, is write down the decision and write down who was involved in making it. And sometimes it'll be a CFO. Yeah, we're just not giving you that extra, you know, $100,000 budget or whatever the number is. That's okay. We're not blaming the CFO and, oh, it's your fault, blah, blah, blah. But we need to understand how a decision is made, who was involved, and if a decision is made such as we're not having resiliency by default, making sure that we document what the potential risk is, what the impact is, how we could recover, and making sure that is also communicated across the organization. Because if a CFO sees that and goes, oh, I had no idea that if we're down, if we lose that one thing, we're down for 8 hours, that's going to cost us $10 million. And all you needed was a 10 grand, you know, N plus one host or something. He may well make a very different decision. He or she might make a different decision. So that's why I like documenting things. It's when someone reads it, a lot of the time they go, oh, okay, yeah, maybe I was a bit hasty to say no.
yeah,
I think definitely. That's the value of good architecture. And the enterprise and the traceability we talked about earlier and mapping all the way from technical to business, I think is key to making sure we're justifying things to a CFO or a CEO or a decision maker. So hence why you and I have a job is, you know, we're helping customers understand what they can and can't do and what the implications are, and hopefully getting them all the budget they need to do things to a reasonable standard.
Correct. And it's about providing one of the things that I always provide is options. A recommended option out of those three is maybe three, it may be five. It's usually more than two, because two options, you know, take it or leave it. Do nothing will be one of them. What's the cost of us doing nothing? Then we can go down path A, path B. That's three right there. So that's that. But it's documenting those options, putting some costs around them, putting a recommended option, but then accepting that the final decision might lie with my customer or my client. And if they choose not to take the recommended approach, that's fine, but it's documented. And we can at least show, hey, we gave this due diligence and due rigor. And maybe the recommended one from me as the industry expert, I didn't have all the knowledge or the insights available, so I had to make some assumptions, and that's why we pivoted. So it's certainly, and this is where good governance comes into it, is a good architect should be prepared to put their viewpoint forward, but also not get hung up on making sure that viewpoint is the winning viewpoint. If you can put a compelling case and the decision's to go somewhere else, great, document it and move on. If it goes against your personal morals and ethics, that's a different conversation that you've got to be having. But at the end of the day, there's someone's got to trade off. And sometimes you'll win that trade off and sometimes you won't.
Yeah, and if you're not getting the recommended solution, it's important that whatever is implemented, you're still doing good architecture with.
Great.
So, yeah, cool. If this risk, you know, actually occurs, it's a medium impact risk, or it's, let's say, a medium likelihood risk, and it's a medium impact, cool. Let's do architecture in that scenario. How do we recover? What's it look like? You know, who needs to be involved? And simple things like, I love the ask from customers is, oh, if we have a failure or something, can we just automatically fail over somewhere? Sure. Yeah, we can. We can definitely get you in a situation where you're probably going to have some false positives as well. But who's going to make a call when to fail over? Who's declaring that there is an issue significant enough to implement some kind of plan, which more than likely has manual steps and implications to potentially data loss or availability and things like that? So, like you say, it's not just technical. It's very much a business process. And no matter what the decision is, there's work to be done. So my job as architects, yeah, not get too emotionally invested in a decision, but just help people be successful regardless.
Agreed.
So cloud exit strategies was one of our last points I wanted to cover, because this is I feel like this is a buzzword, but it's actually a buzzword that makes sense. How do we get out of wherever we are if there's a problem and move to somewhere else in a timely manner?
Comes down to the it's a bit glib, but it comes down to the architects, really. It's an architectural conversation. You know, it's what is the problem we're trying to solve here, and why are we trying to get away from that? What's the exit plan? To me, I don't see an exit plan as a singular point in time thing of if we ever need to walk ourselves back from AWS, then this is where we're going to go. It comes back to some of those earlier points we made about the services you're using and consuming around AWS to perform the various functions of your application. You might need an exit strategy from each of those, but still have the broader, we're maintaining now, we're hosting or running in cloud with AWS, but something's been switched off. How are we going to unplug that and plug the next one in? I guess it's there's going to be a lot of ifs, buts, and maybes in there. And for me, rather than an exit strategy, is probably what's more valuable is a review point. So an architectural review point, whether it be quarterly, might be too frequent, annually, probably just right. You wouldn't want to do it any less than that. If you were going to, maybe 2 years would be enough. But just a review of your architecture. What have we got? What is its status, and what is it looking like in the future? And what's our plan to mitigate any risk out of that? And then that might give you the broad brush exit strategy of that whole environment we're running in is about to be switched off. So what's our plan B, and how quickly can we run it? Versus actually it's just the authentication layer for our users as they log in. That's been deprecated and we need to move to a new one. Great. We don't have to touch the rest of the architecture, but how do we plug that in and close that gap?
Yeah, so I think you've nailed it. It's dependency mapping. So we've got a solution. What's it dependent on? And if one of those dependencies changes, what are we going to do? And, you know, the one people always go to is, oh, what if AWS, you know, suddenly puts their prices up, you know, 5x? You know, how do we get out of there? You know, because we can't afford it at that point. So that's like the extreme end of the scale. The other end of the scale is, yeah, one service is modified to where it's no longer minimally viable for a customer. Cool. How do we replace that one service and leave everything else, you know, as is? Because in most cases, it's a service changes, the way a product functions due to an upgrade might change slightly, and it might have an impact. So like you say, a full architecture review doesn't need to be done every week or month or 6 months. Probably annually is, like you say, probably a sweet spot. But subcomponents of architecture is probably a living thing. We're looking at things constantly on how we can improve and, you know, mitigate risk and minimize the number of dependencies we have.
Absolutely. And that's where whoever, and I won't say the role of the architect because it doesn't have to be a specific person. It could be a function of the organization, of a group of people coming together to make architectural decisions or reviews. But you need to be keeping an eye on what's happening out in the broader ecosystem as well, and just whether it's keeping an eye on the headlines or keeping an eye on the industry papers as they come through, understanding what's going on, because that's the bit that it will catch you out if deprecation of a service comes as a surprise to you. That's where you're going to get caught out.
Yeah,
things never happen overnight. Everything's forecasted out. You know, in quarter four 2024, we're going to put the price up, or we're going to deprecate this, or we're going to no longer offer this service. Great. So I've got 18 months to figure out how to get away from, or break it back. It's not 18 months to figure it out. I've got 18 months in total, some of which needs to be spent figuring out how we're going to move away from that, and some of which is going to be actually delivering that migration plan as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And highlighting that if we don't do something in that time frame, the cost implications is whatever it is. So yeah, absolutely. I just I had a question I was going to ask you, and it's just slipped my mind, of course, as it always happens. But what was I going to say? God, it doesn't matter. But it'll come back to me at some point. So yeah, what I was going to say is actually about architecture reviews, and I feel like, you know, for example, I was at Nutanix for 9 years, so my perspective of the market, you know, was somewhat at least influenced by my employer. Prior to that, I was at IBM, and again, my perspective was, you know, from that more blue angle. Everything was painted blue. So I think an internal enterprise or solution architect at a company has a great and very detailed view of that organization. But I feel like in my experience, those people always complain that they don't have a broad enough viewpoint of the market to perform their role to the level they want. Mm. And I think if you and I were put into one company for a certain amount of time and it was an internal customer sort of role, we lose that broader perspective over time, even if we've had it in the past. So to me, I think there's a lot of value with internal people who are experts in that one environment collaborating actively with external experts so that the perspective of both is broadened. So the external consultant knows more about the internal environment due to that person, but also the internal knows more about, like you say, what's coming down the pipeline from that external consultant. So I think architecture review boards should always include external people as well.
Yeah.
And ideally a trusted partner where you can do that on a semi-regular basis. And they can maintain some sort of knowledge of your internal environment as well as giving that external perspective. Because I think, you know, if I'm a CIO of a company, it's pretty unreasonable and unrealistic for me to expect my internal staff to be experts at everything out in the field.
Mm.
So I think there's a really good balance between having great staff internally and also maintaining strategic relationships with external companies. I'm sort of pitching my own company there in a way, because that's what we do, but I certainly don't think that we know everything.
Mm.
I don't know everything about all my customers either. So there is a partnership there.
Mm.
And I think that's a huge risk mitigation because, you know, my team might bring an industry perspective that isn't obvious to most customers, and the customers might bring a perspective, you know, that we're not seeing day to day either. And from that's a really good, you know, match made in heaven.
100%. And I'll give a plug to AWS on this one, because that's where I think they've got it quite in a good position. One of the clients I work with, fully hosted on AWS, has a moderate amount of spend with them each month. It's not significant, but it's not low either. And AWS have provided to them a cloud solutions architect who is knowledgeable in AWS and the solutions AWS provides, but is seeing the broader picture of how others are out there applying their logic into those solutions as well. So I was able to come in, and instead of, they're not part of the team, they're not part of the organization, they are very separate and independent, but they're able to come in and go, hey, this is what we're seeing, and this is what we recommend you do with your environment to make sure it's more stable, to reduce cost. That seems to be a focus that I've picked up from AWS, is that they are, as a company, their focus is on helping customers manage cost, because they understand the longer game better than the, you know, it's not about the monthly spend, it's about the 18-month or the 18-year spend journey that's going to happen. So I feel, and I can't speak for every jurisdiction, this is what's happening in New Zealand, but I feel that that's a good model that they're delivering, is because we can bring that architect in, run a review, and have that independent voice from outside going, this is what everyone else is doing, and we can sit there and go, great, this is the direction we choose to take, or we'll go in a different direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing that's important is not just get, like, let's say Josh coming in every 6 months and looking at your environment, get a fresh set of eyes.
Mm.
So one of the things I like to do with my team is, if a customer needs something, cool, let's deliberately use someone else, right, to get that different perspective, different skill set. And then if there's, let's say one of my team disagrees with something I've previously recommended, fantastic. Like, let's have a discussion about that, because we've got two experts giving an expert opinion, which might differ. Let's see if there's a middle ground. Let's see if someone's just, you know, made a mistake, or whether, you know, there's a better option. So, you know, I think that's valuable too, is an internal enterprise architect getting multiple perspectives and then being able to translate those into something that works specifically in that environment is fantastic.
Yeah, agreed. And in the same way that from a security lens, you bring in different companies to do pen testing regularly. It's not saying that the first company you use that did the pen testing is wrong or is not as good as the next one. What it's saying is that they may have missed something, or things may have evolved that the next one's going to pick up, and everyone gets to learn from that because you're going to share that knowledge around. Equally, if you start to just continue to focus on that same pen tester, or in this case, that same enterprise architect, things can just start to get a little bit stale, and there's the risk of turf protection. You know, 3 years ago, I made that decision, and the world's changed. But I don't want to show everyone that I was wrong.
Mm.
You know, it's not about being wrong, It's about having different knowledge brought to the table.
Yeah, and like we said earlier, it's a decision is a point in time. And 5 minutes after we make a decision that's very well justified and we think is correct, it may well be simply outdated.
Yeah.
You know, AWS or Azure or whoever might release a new capability or a new way of doing something, which means that an assumption was wrong, a dependency is no longer an issue, or a constraint's not there. So we don't have to be emotional about it, these decisions. We just say, cool, here's our point in time. Here's the information we had when we made it. Let's review these. Let's have a look at things. And that's like in the AWS example, if they've got an architect coming in and go, hey, yeah, that was a constraint 6 months ago. It's no longer a constraint. You should really do this because it'll save you a fortune or your performance will increase or something. You know, that's extremely valuable. So we can't set and forget, especially in the public cloud where things are changing, you know, constantly, whereas on-prem, obviously, things change a lot less frequently. So I think that's a change organizations need to have as well, is be prepared to change with the cloud provider to get the most out of it, as opposed to on-prem where, fair enough, you're not going to change that often, but you might be slightly more stable and secure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very cool. So we've covered on-prem, private cloud, cloud native, and probably the last one I want to touch on because a favorite of mine, the hyperscaler with the hypervisor layer. What's your experience with this? Have you heard of it? Is it nonsense? What do you think?
I've heard of it. I won't say I've got a lot of experience with them, and that's coming from because my background has been largely non-technical to get to where I've got to. So infrastructure and solution architects and infrastructure engineers and developers have obviously been playing this part. So I had to actually, on this one, because they're both components that I've heard of, familiar with, when it's recommended that we bring them in, hey, I'm not going to argue with people, the experts on that, but I still couldn't explain them. So I went to ChatGPT and
fantastic.
Said...
Fantastic. So you're an expert, like, now.
I'm an expert. I said, and I used the playground analogy earlier, and it's funny that ChatGPT also brought this up, but I said to her, look, explain it to me like I'm five. And I'll let the audience be the judge of how well it's done this, but it talks about the, it uses a playground, it uses children's environment as a model, but what it says is the hypervisor lets you take a big toy box, which it's referring to as the server, into smaller sections, so you can play different games without mixing them up. So what it's talking about is saying those smaller sections, they're virtual machines. So it's just saying, like, you take your toy box, you split it up, you can continue to play, and you're not going to mix everything up. The hyperscaler, what it then gets to is it's just saying, look, imagine you've got a playground that grows and shrinks depending on how many friends you've got playing with you at any one time in that playground. Like I say, I wouldn't call myself the expert now. I feel like it's probably done a good job of explaining it to a five-year-old, but I'll let the audience determine if scaled playgrounds and segmented toy boxes are a good way of looking at it.
Yeah, it's not bad. Yeah, I don't mind that at all. To me, it's from a more technical angle. It's I explain this to customers all the time, actually. If you think about virtualization, we took physical servers and we virtualized them and consolidated them using the hypervisor. Cool. Pretty much everyone agrees this is a good idea now. It's been done for a long time. Pretty much every app's very successfully virtualized at this point. If we now take a cloud native instance and we put an application in it, it's kind of like going back to a physical server where we're buying an instance for a workload and it's either oversized or undersized or correctly sized. You don't really know. And then if we put the hypervisor on top of the hyperscaler, we now get all the benefits back of virtualization. We get the overcommitment, we get the efficiency at the storage layer and things like that. So to me, cloud native is somewhat like having a physical server in the way it's consumed, which can be very efficient and it can be very inefficient depending on how it's done. And the hypervisor allows us to get back some of the virtualization efficiencies. So that's kind of my little explain it to not quite the five-year-old, but that's what I say to customers. And yeah, I think there's a lot of potential value there. You know, the requirement to refactor, for example, is not there. You could run VMware on AWS or VMware on Azure, and you could just move your workload there in a sort of lift and shift or a data center exit manner. And I feel like that's a good use case for some people who, you know, don't want to manage that on-prem piece, whether it's for cost on-prem or complexity, or they just want to get out of that space. I think it's a very interesting option for a lot of customers.
Certainly, and it also it helps with peaks and troughs in demand without having to build a staircase model around cost. You know, if you're on-prem and you know that Christmas is a busy period, you're a retail organization, Christmas is busy, you get a lot of online transactions through that time, and you want to you need to scale, it becomes the staircase model. Because what I mean by that is every new server you add on has a cost associated to it that doesn't drop off. Whereas the hyperscaler, hypervisor model starts to allow that more of a wave peak and trough model of we know that we're going to have busy periods, we're going to scale up, and then we're going to throttle it back a little bit just to help ourselves manage our costs and not not end up with an environment that's fit for purpose for 3 months of the year that we have to run and maintain for 12 months of the year.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a huge value. So you get your steady state, you pay for 3 years, and then, yeah, you pay as you go for that burst. And even though the pay as you go rates, you know, can be quite high, obviously, if you're paying for it for 3 years, if the cost of pay as you go is less than that 3 years, then you've got a commercial benefit from it.
So, yeah, agreed.
You know, I think it's, even though it does look expensive sometimes when you burst, I think it's well worth it for that flexibility and time to agree as well.
I agree, absolutely.
Yeah, well, I think we've nailed it, actually. We've covered off all these topics pretty well, and we've actually not gone too long. Hour and 15 is pretty good.
It's not too bad at all.
Not too bad for an Australian and a Kiwi who can rattle on.
So, we didn't get sidetracked with any of the sports that's going on, none of that, so we did quite well to stay on topic.
Yeah, absolutely. No politics or anything. So, yeah, I think we've done well. Well, I think we'll wrap up there. I appreciate your time, and I look forward to interacting with you more in the future, especially on CIO Chat, and seeing what more topics we can potentially do a part two on.
Likewise, and certainly appreciate the invite to come on board and to just share some thoughts and views as well. So thanks for that, Josh, and thanks for your time.
Fantastic. Thanks very much.